In this week's edition of Different Matters, I sit down with Dr. Don Brash. As most of you know, Dr. Don Brash was leader of the ACT Party. He was leader of the National Party. He very nearly became Prime Minister, but for the whims of Winston Peters. Don Brash was also Governor of the Reserve Bank, but he's had a very interesting early part of his career, which I think is often overlooked, and we discussed that. Some of his commercial career with merchant banking and his associations with three people in particular, Alan Gibbs, Milton Friedman, and Robert McNamara. It's an interesting excursion, and I rely on two books, one written by Don Brash himself, and the other written by Paul Goldsmith. I hope you find it rewarding. Thank you. Welcome to my podcast, Different Matters. Today, I'm very excited to be talking to Dr. Don Brash. Don, thanks for coming on board.
You're welcome.
As we were talking just before we started, your career has been so remarkable that there is just no way we can cover it in an hour. And also, there's so much contemporary commentary that I'd be interested in. So I'm going to cherry pick some aspects of it that I think are interesting, at least interesting for me. But just a quick snapshot. So, son of a Presbyterian minister, master's in economics, PhD at ANU, where you did a 180 degree on your views on foreign investment. Then off to the US, World Bank, Pearson Committee, which we'll talk about. Back to New Zealand, ran Broadbank for 9 years. East Coast Bays, by-election didn't go well. Kiwi Fruit Authority, Trust Bank, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, National Act, Hobson's Choice, Don Brash, and the elevator pitch. But I want to start with Robert McNamara. Now, a lot of people listening here won't know who he is. Who is he?
Well, he was, of course, briefly a very senior executive. I think he was president of Ford Motor Company, brought in to head the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, by Kennedy, President Kennedy, and was widely regarded as the guy who drove American policy on Vietnam. It's clear that at some point he realized that Vietnam had been a ghastly mistake. And it's widely believed, and I share that view, that he sought a role at the World Bank in part to make atonement for Vietnam. And he became president of the World Bank very shortly after I joined the World Bank as a very, very junior staffer. And immediately he set up something called the Commission on International Development, or frequently referred to as the Pearson Commission, because it was chaired by Lester Pearson, former Prime Minister of Canada. And it had a staff of 12, three of them from the World Bank, and I was lucky enough to be one of the three.
Yeah, I don't buy this false modesty that you were lucky. I think there was an enormous amount of skill to get in the room, but we can come back to that. So, actually, no, just very briefly, the Pearson Committee, because that's kind of interesting in itself. So what did that do?
It was intended to review post-war history in terms of economic development, what had worked in economic development, what had not worked, what could we learn from the previous 20 years, roughly. And the commission itself had seven members, and they were the great and the good from a variety of places. Douglas Dillon, former Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, and so on. High-profile international citizens, and a staff of 12.
And the conclusion was?
Well, there were a whole series of different conclusions, but the basic message, I suppose, was we're on the right track, we should do more. And it was argued for more foreign aid, more open trade. My chapter argued for more direct foreign investment because I was a strong believer in foreign investment.
That was your PhD.
Yeah.
Was it the Pearson Committee or somewhere else? I was reading that there was a view that where money went into a country that had strong institutions, there was a real tangible benefit, particularly in Asia and some Asian countries. But where the institutions were weak, it was a waste of money.
That was the Pearson Commission. Of those seven high-profile individuals on the commission itself. One was a guy called Arthur Lewis, W.A. Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. He was widely regarded as one of, if not the, international expert in economic growth in developing countries. I didn't know till I met him that he was actually black. He was from the West Indies. And at the very first meeting of the commission, where I'd written a paper on why foreign investment was great for recipient countries, he disagreed. And I was shattered because he was the one economist of standing on the commission itself. And here he was disagreeing with my basic message.
The temerity.
Yeah. And Lester Pearson said to the to Arthur Lewis and me, look, you guys sort this out over lunch, if you would. And we did. And he said, look, I didn't want to be an economist. I wanted to be an engineer. That's right. But he said the bastards wouldn't let me. And by then,
I'm sure that was for racist reasons. That's the
It probably was in those days. The main multinationals he wanted to join were aluminium companies, as I recall, and they didn't want to hire him. And he said, look, basically, you're right about foreign investment. It's a huge benefit if the recipient country has got straight, clean institutions. You haven't got politicians siphoning off a lot of the benefit into their back pocket. But in many developing countries, that's not the case.
Oh, and that was his specific insight.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So, because the other thing, because your father was kicking around at the time, he was based in
Geneva.
Yeah, Geneva as head of one of the world churches. Your father was a pacifist.
Yes, he was.
And for a while, you were.
Yes, I was.
Still. It's a real, real world beating that out of you, Don.
Not now, no. I can see there are legitimate reasons for the use of military force.
So, in that situation, how? Because you met McNamara and spent a little bit of time with him.
Well, yes. Go back to McNamara, because when the Pearson Commission was finished its role and published its book, three of us who had come from the World Bank Group went back to the World Bank. I had a number of options open to me there. One of which was joining what was called the Programming and Budgeting Department of the World Bank, which was McNamara's staff department, in effect. And there were eight professionals in it, and I was one of them. And it was a fantastic couple of years because McNamara was very, very bright, highly intelligent, and it was very stimulating working with him. I mean, he was a man of huge profile in the United States, too. But one thing I learned from working with him was that if you're very intelligent and a very strong personality, the risk is that you change behavior of the people directly beneath you. They tend to say, yes, sir, three bags full, sir, when they should say, I'm sorry, sir, that won't work. And the dramatic example in my case was that McNamara wanted to, the World Bank was lending at the time at 6% per annum and was borrowing money at 6.25%. And the World Bank board was saying to the president, Mr. McNamara, we can't continue doing this. So he asked the head of the department I was in to do what was called a thoughtful think piece on our lending rate, interest rate. And I was asked to write the paper. And I wrote the paper. It didn't take great genius to work out that you can't very long lend at a rate lower than you're borrowing at. And I recommended that we increase the rate. My head of department was incensed by this. He said, look, McNamara doesn't want to raise the rates. Developing countries have got debt problems and so on. I said, that's absolutely fair comment. And his decision is the final one. It must be the right one. I mean, he's got the right to make the decision. Mm. But we have an obligation to tell him what the facts are. I was taken off the project my temerity. Fortunately, my head of department then left for a holiday, or for a trip anyway, and I was able to persuade the guy who did the report after I left it that I had been right, and we put a paper to McNamara when the head of the department was away.
Did it change his position, McNamara?
No, McNamara was highly intelligent. He could see the logic of what we're saying. I can't recall how much we did raise the interest rate.
Because that had a bearing on your thinking of management forward.
It did. I realized that critical if you're going to be a chief executive, you must have people around you who are willing to say, no, Don, that won't work. Mm. And I was lucky enough to have people right through my career who would do that. I mentioned in the book that the first person I ever dismissed, in fact, was a guy who always agreed with me, or the chairman, if he was in the room.
So just describe Robert McNamara, because it's kind of remarkable that I'm sitting here talking to somebody who had interaction with the man who was largely responsible for Vietnam. That is just, for me, kind of remarkable. So you knew him?
Yes, I can't claim I knew him personally.
Yeah.
There was a lot of professional contact with him. And I'm convinced that he had, as I said earlier, realized that Vietnam had been a ghastly mistake, felt bad about it, and he was very keen indeed to expand the World Bank's operations substantially. He wanted to double our lending in a hurry. And again...
And this was some form of atonement for him?
I think it was.
So I mentioned there were three people I wanted to talk about. The next one is Milton Friedman. Now, you knew Milton Friedman.
I was lucky enough to have a number of contacts with him. The first one, ironically, was triggered by my good friend Alan Gibbs, who...
Well, he's the next on the list.
He, at that point, was chief executive of an investment bank called Chase NBA.
Yes.
Partly affiliated with Chase Manhattan Bank in the States. And he had brought to New Zealand some economist, and I can't recall who it was now, and toured him around the country, American economist, and people thought, wow. And I thought, now, how do I upstage my friend?
Was that it?
Well, yeah.
Because you were head of World Bank at the time.
That's correct.
And yeah. So
we were competing investment banks. And I was looking for some way of upstaging him. And I thought, look, the only person I can think of who would ace him, he can't top it, is Milton Friedman. I approached him without much expectation that he would come to New Zealand, but by extremely good fortune, he was visiting Australia, and he said he'd be happy to come across to New Zealand, no cost to Broadbank, except travel costs between Sydney and New Zealand. But he asked if we would take him and his wife around the South Island as part of the fee.
Yes.
So my then wife and I spent... 3 or 4 days traveling around Queenstown, Milford Sound, etc., with Milton and Rose Friedman.
That was 1981?
That's correct. And subsequently, of course, I had a number of meetings with him in San Francisco at his home.
What was the connection that gave you the chutzpah in 81 to ask him?
Well, I'd probably just read Free to Choose,
yes,
which he and his wife had written, and was blown away by the insights in
so
that
just,
book.
You just off the cuff made an act.
Yeah, I had no previous contact with him at all. So just very, very lucky.
Well, also at this time, so help me get the understanding. Muldoon was still kicking around at the time. Was this before or after East Coast Bays?
This would have been after East Coast Bays by-election.
Okay, so you'd come second in East Coast Bays. Reading, because this the basis of this interview is both your book, Incredible Luck, and Don Brash, Brash by Paul Goldsmith. We'll come to that in a minute. It's kind of interesting. But I can't remember where I read it. I think it was in Goldsmith's book that Friedman was going around criticizing the tariff and quota issues on cars, which irritated Muldoon enormously and didn't make you any friends within the government at the time. Do you remember that?
Well, he was certainly criticising much of what the then Muldoon government was doing. No question. I can't recall the specific one about tariffs on cars. But I took Milton Friedman to see a subset of the cabinet, which was Muldoon's cabinet, but Muldoon himself was not there. And I can't recall if he wasn't in the country or what the story was, but he wasn't in the meeting.
Of course not. He would have.
That's right.
Diametrically opposed.
There was discussion about social credit, of course, and one of the cabinet ministers, I can't recall now who it was, maybe in George Gere, said, you know, one of the problems is that social credit is stealing votes from National on the right, and we're the right-wing party. And Friedman, who had briefed fairly comprehensively on what actually was the situation in New Zealand, was absolutely beautiful. He said, you mean you're the right wing party? the cabinet members who were present were looking very, very sheepish. as I say, subsequently, of course, when I became governor of the Reserve Bank, we'll get to that a bit later, but I maintained some contact with him, and he visited New Zealand on a cruise ship, visited Auckland, was going to fly to Wellington. Unfortunately, either Auckland Airport was out or Wellington Airport was out, and he couldn't fly down, so we just had a long conversation on the phone. But as I say, I had several meals with him at his home, and then astonishingly, he accepted an invitation to have dinner at our home in Auckland. Again, he visited the Auckland on a cruise ship. And at that point, he was in his early 90s. He and Rose both in the early 90s.
Yes.
So I wasn't quite sure how physically or mentally competent he would be.
Yeah.
So I thought, I can't organize a public meeting, not knowing quite what the story would be. So I invited only two people to the dinner. John Key and Judith Collins. That's right. They were my colleagues from the 2002 intake.
So the thing I've written about this is a little bit mean. Judith Collins writes in her autobiography, she writes about that meeting, and then she said she was so excited she went away to read Free to Choose. And I think I made something on the lines of, if you're a conservative politician or Murnau, and that's what it takes to get you to read Free to Choose, maybe you're in the wrong... John Key hasn't written an autobiography, so we don't know whether what he made of that meeting, whether he's read Free to Choose yet. But clearly the lessons didn't take in John, sadly. Never mind. Alan Gibbs, you were our primary school friends with him.
Yeah, I had done my first year of primary schooling in Whanganui, moved to Christchurch when my father changed jobs, and skipped what was then called Primer 4, which I think these days we called Year 2, I think it was.
Yeah.
Went into the same class as Alan. And Alan was not only in that class, he was also in the house next door to where I was living. So he was both a neighbor and a colleague at school. And we became good friends from that time on.
And you, so did you go to the same university?
He went to Vic, because he moved to Wellington quite early on in his childhood, did at least some of his university work at Vic in Wellington, but then moved to Christchurch. I didn't have much contact with him in Christchurch, funnily enough. He was doing engineering.
You guys with the Reserve Bank?
Well, that's true. When I had done four papers for my master's degree, the then deputy governor of the Reserve Bank said, look, if you'd like to write your thesis at the Reserve Bank, we can make our library available to you, give you a modest income while you're writing it, and then hopefully you might stay on as a Reserve Bank staffer. And when I got to the Reserve Bank, I discovered Alan was also in the same research department of the Reserve Bank. I'm not quite sure how long he was there, but I was there about 6 months.
Did he do economics? What was his... Pardon? Why was he there?
I'm not sure. I can't recall why he was there, but he certainly didn't major in economics.
Yeah.
I was there for about 6 months, and he was there for most of that time.
That was before you went to Australia?
Yes, as I was finishing my master's degree.
So apparently there was some speculation that, was it you saying that Alan would become prime minister or something?
Yeah,
and somebody said he was too abrasive.
In that Reserve Bank environment, we were a research department of six people in the same room. And one day when Alan was not actually in the room, I said to the other guys, I said, this guy will be prime minister one day. And someone else said, no, he's too abrasive to be prime minister. And there was something in that.
Maybe you weren't abrasive enough. This, I think, is interesting. So there you are. If I'm getting the timeline correct, you're at the Reserve Bank. Alan was connected to Jenny or not to show they're a couple.
They were a couple, but not yet married.
Right. So Jenny Gibbs, you and Alan were outraged at a proposal to increase the parliamentary term for 4 years. So you guys set up the Association for the Preservation of Democracy. Okay, explain yourself.
No, that's exactly right. We were committed to the three-year term in those days. We've all three moved a bit since then, I think.
Yes.
Those days you could send letters to the editor over pseudonyms. Which we did.
I just imagine Don Brett sitting there.
We created an impression that we were a really major organization.
Do you remember some of the names?
No, not much. I think Mother of Five in Tawa was...
Yes. Outrageous.
Yeah, can't do it these days.
Well, I mean, you kind of can. I mean, a lot of social media is anonymous, right?
Well, that's true.
So, but that campaign was successful.
Well, we didn't move to 4 years anyway. Whether that was our contribution or not, I'm not sure.
Jenny Gibbs, quoted in Goldsmith's book, says, quote, she was surprised how incredibly easy it was in New Zealand to get your message out, how lazy many in the media were, and how easily influenced a small society like New Zealand could be.
Yeah.
Which I think, you know, is probably a lesson that's carried with you in some way.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
The next thing I wanted to talk about is, well, actually, let's talk about Broadlands. So you go overseas, we're speaking briefly about that, and you come back and you are running what sounds like a merchant bank in a reasonably highly regulated environment. And you were there for 9 years.
Nearly 10, in fact. Yeah, that's right.
So what did that... I mean, I know what a merchant banker does now, but what did a merchant banker do then?
Well, in those days, we were primarily focused on providing finance to medium and large-sized corporates through the commercial paper market.
What's a commercial paper market?
Well, we used bills of exchange drawn on the investment bank by a major company, let's say New Zealand Forest Products or Alex Harvey Industries.
So this is New Zealand Forest Products saying, I want to borrow $1 million, and they issue a note.
Right, which we buy and
so
sell.
So you'd buy it for $1 million or whatever the price was, and then you would sell it to the market.
And a small margin, yeah. And
so why do they need the reserve? Why do they need a merchant bank? Why can't they just go to the
market themselves? Well, because the banking sector was tightly controlled, and we were effectively bypassing the tight controls of the banking sector.
Did you have a banking license?
No. There were only five banks in those days, because there were four for a time before the banking sector was deregulated, but there were five for a time. But banks were unable to pay any interest on deposits shorter than 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a ready market for people who had significant chunks of cash which they wanted to invest, and they bought commercial bills.
Right.
And it was quite a major operation. I mean, there were four or five.
Because you were really young.
Yeah. I became chief executive at 31, yeah.
And then competing with Gibbs as well, because he was running around at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
So one of the questions I've got, so Gibbs goes off and makes a whole pile of money. You don't. There must have been in your mind at some point, why don't I do what Alan has done and go and make a huge pile of cash?
I was never as entrepreneurial as Alan. Alan was a real entrepreneur in the real meaning of that word. He would take risks and gamble in a commercial sense big, and he reaped the rewards of that. I was always much more timid. I gambled in other ways, like going into politics.
Well, this is what Paul Goldsmith writes. Quoting Goldsmith, his real passion was public policy. His first love was grappling with the issues dealt with by the Planning Council and economic monitoring groups. This is talking about that time. If Don Brash was sitting up at 2 a.m. worrying about something, he was not sitting there applying all his brain power to figure out how he can make an extra dollar from Broadbank. He was trying to solve the riddle of New Zealand's living standards. There came a point when there was clearly no use going to going on to urge Muldoon from the sidelines to grasp the challenge of the hour. Something more positive was called for. Is that accurate?
I think it is accurate, yeah. And I went into East Coast Bay, as the book recalls, almost by accident. I got enrolled in the National Party at someone else's initiative. I didn't take any initiative to do it at all. I hadn't thought of getting into politics directly.
Yeah.
And found myself worked like hell to win that East Coast Bay by-election. Got a significantly higher proportion of the vote than Frank Gill, who had been my predecessor, got.
Mm-hmm.
Was very surprised when I lost.
Tactical voting.
Yes, tactical voting. Even more so the following year in the general election. I was the third highest polling National Party candidate in the country in 1981, after Muldoon and I think John Falloon, from memory. But I lost because the Labour vote collapsed to 12%. Labour voters realised they couldn't win East Coast Bays, but they could deprive National of the seat by voting for Social Credit.
Which is smart tactical voting.
Absolutely right. And I look back on that. I mean, at the time, I was devastated because I worked like a galley slave to win that seat.
Yes.
But I look back and I was like, thank heavens I lost that. Because won, I'd have been in Muldoon's caucus watching him do everything I disagreed with. And then I'd be in opposition watching Roger Douglas do everything I'd agreed with from opposition. I would never have been Reserve Bank governor. I'd never have done the GSC thing, etc. So I'm very lucky I lost that election.
So... Then you come into a really interesting time. So you go from there, winding up Muldoon with Milton Friedman. That is just a classic. That is very much you, to be fair. You then got caught up into all of these government advisory roles, the Monetary and Economic Council. Muldoon was asking you to advise on stuff called accrual accounting. So you were... You were in the Kiwi Bank, not Kiwi Bank, no, Kiwi Fruit.
No, that was earlier. I was running Broadbank. I was appointed to the Monetary and Economic Council by the Labour government of Bill Rowling.
Yeah.
Muldoon didn't like the advice that body was giving to the government, so he scrapped it. Instead set up the New Zealand Planning Council under Frank Holmes, Sir Frank Holmes. And I was on that. But because there was such an outcry about the abolition of the Monetary and Economic Council, he then set up the Economic Monitoring Group looking at short-term issues, and I was appointed chairman of that.
And that was under Muldoon.
Yes, early on in his 9-year period. But the other thing he did, of course, you mentioned...
That was the New Zealand Planning Council, wasn't it?
New Zealand
not Planning the economic monitor, I think, because you set up the economic monitoring after planning was scrapped.
New Zealand Planning Council was set up by Muldoon shortly after the 75 election.
Yeah.
Because the Monetary and Economic Council had been scrapped by Muldoon with some uproar, he set up the Economic Monitoring Group as a kind of a subset of the Planning Council. I chaired that.
Okay. All right. No, right. I got the impression that was the Economic Monitoring Group was a private thing.
Of the Planning Council.
All right.
Sort of.
What was it about Don Brash that was making people say, he's the guy I want? Because I don't think it's luck. There must have been, you know, you were talking before about you got the job in the United States. So you met this guy, Sir John Crawford, who was obviously a very influential guy in Australia. He was obviously deeply impressed, and he made the introductions over into the United States.
That's right.
So it can't just have been luck.
I call it incredible luck for a good reason, because, I mean, just to talk about that period of time also, one of my three examiners for the PhD thesis was a guy called Kindleberger. Uh-huh. Kindleberger, for those who are not economists, is a very high-profile American economist. And the Australian National University Press, which decided they wanted to publish the thesis, wrote to Kindleberger as one of my three examiners to say, look, this is about American investment in Australia. Might there be merit in co-publishing with someone in the US? And he literally wrote back, and there was no email in those days, and said, look, I've just had lunch with my friend, the president of Harvard University Press, and I've told him we should publish it.
Yeah, now, but if the book, if your thesis had been rubbish.
Well, that's true.
Tom.
That's true. I mean, no question, I had to have a reasonable level of competence. But you and I both know there are millions and millions of people who have a high level of competence who don't get lucky breaks that I've had.
That's possibly true. Let's just talk about some of the things that you did. Most of the influence that you had was after Muldoon had left office and the fourth Labor government was kicking around.
Yeah.
The accrual tax treatment of income and expenditure. It sounds so dry.
It is.
But when I read what you did, I was outraged. So explain yourself, Don. What did you do? What a fantastic tax loophole. Given that tax is theft, there was a wonderful way to evade it, and you closed the loophole.
That's right. And I closed it because most of the people around Auckland who were using the loophole, top tax accountants, top tax lawyers, etc., wanted it closed.
So it wasn't evasion, it was avoided.
It was not illegal at all.
Yes.
I'm not sure that I can in short compass explain it, but you were able I won't try and explain it. I mean,
my understanding of it is I've got $1 million worth of income and I've got $800,000 worth of expenses. So I've got $200,000 profit. And I thought, well, yeah, I think maybe, I'll put an extra $200,000 of accruals, which is kind of like a forecast unexpected expenses in the system, because I think those costs might come. There's some person might sue me for a leaky building somewhere. So I put that in.
No, it's not quite as blatant as that. Not quite as blatant as that. It's a way of bringing forward
expense
interest, particularly on financial instruments.
Right.
You issue a zero coupon bond, say.
Yes.
And you issued a discount of, say, 20%.
Yeah.
Because you're not paying interest on this bond. And you could deduct that immediately as an expense.
So you could bring that forward.
Yeah, yeah. That was the main thing. But the tax accountants and tax lawyers, people like Robin Congreve, Keith Sutton and others, who were using these loopholes aggressively, I don't know whether they felt guilty or not, but in any case, they recognized the trade-off was getting the corporate rate, tax rate, way down.
Yeah.
And of course, it was 48% when Roger Diggs arrived. It was 33% when he got stuck in.
Of course, according to your book, you got pinged yourself from your bank account in Geneva.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Because, among other things, you had to work out what foreign exchange gains and losses you may have had on any foreign currency assets. And I had a very small bank deposit in Geneva set up when my parents were living in Geneva, and they would put Christmas presents and birthday presents and things into it. It was a very modest amount of money, but I was caught.
That is karma, Don.
Yeah,
that is karma. And also I discovered, this is shocking, this was in Goldsmith's book, but not in yours, and rightly so, comprehensive tax reform and possible interim solutions. Do you remember that? You recommended a capital gains tax, amongst other things.
Did I?
Yes, you did. And I know this because Paul Goldsmith mentioned it, and you've obviously memory-holed it yourself, and said, I didn't do that.
Yep.
Anyway, we'll gloss over that. I went to online to try and find it, but I couldn't. So I'm only going on the summary in Goldsmith's book. But it sounds like you wanted some form of a capital gains tax in there, and so that would bring the actual rate of tax globally down to about 20%.
Yeah, I mean, I recall clearly getting my first and probably only spontaneous standing ovation. Of course, as leader of the National Party, as of other parties, you always get standing ovations from the party faithful when you go to a conference. Mm-hmm. That's sort of obligatory. I got a spontaneous standing ovation once before I was in politics, talking to a farming audience. And I talked about how ludicrous the whole situation for farming was in terms of rate of return. I said, you know, farmers work their guts out for 30 or 40 or 50 years living on the smell of an oily rag.
Yes.
In the hope that in 40 years' time, they get this enormous tax-free capital gain.
Yeah.
I said, much better to have farmers making very good money raising sheep or beef or whatever.
Reducing the tax.
Et cetera. And literally, I got a standing ovation. It was the first and only time I've ever had one.
Then we come to, I think, the two really huge achievements. That, other than, I noticed at Broadbank, you funded the Sleeping Dogs.
Yeah,
You lost a pile of money on it, but it's a great movie.
It's a great movie, and those are the names of four that were sort of all kinds of tax subsidies for making movies. This was a straight hard cash investment.
Yeah,
DFC put some money in, Broadbank put some money in. We both lost our shirt, despite the.
So this was you and Alan Gibbs.
He was Chase. It wasn't a huge sum of money, but. Well, it seemed huge at the time. It was surprising because it ran, I think, for 12 weeks in Auckland. It was very successful in New Zealand, just didn't sell overseas.
Nobody makes money on movies. So you were shoulder tapped by Roger Douglas to write a proposal on GST. And it looks like your proposal, or the proposal that came out, was adopted. Did Douglas have an idea? Obviously, he had some idea about what he wanted, but the mechanics of the GSCs that we've got, which has almost no exemptions, where did that come from? Was that, did Douglas prescribe that from the top, or did that grow organically from the committee?
I don't recall exactly what his instructions were, but he was certainly very comfortable. I think he said, give us the simplest value-added tax in the world.
Yes.
He'd heard horror stories from the UK about small businesses being knocked about by these compliance costs. He said, I want to minimize compliance costs, come up with a system which minimizes compliance costs. And of course, you do that by having no exemptions. And he was willing to face down. In fact, it was ironic. He rang me. I was in Germany at the time, on a KiwiFruit visit. And he asked me to be to run this thing. I came back to New Zealand and found a huge controversy going on about this tax. Labour Party in uproar about it. And I rang him and I said, Roger, it seems to me you need a former National Party candidate chairing this thing, like you need the hole in the head. He said, look, I've got two audiences. One is the Labour Party audience. You can't help me with that. He said, the other is small businesses who are terrified of the compliance costs of this tax because they heard horror stories from the UK. So your responsibility is to sign the tax which minimizes compliance costs.
Mm.
And, of course, it didn't take genius at all to work out that you do that with no exceptions. So, he was extraordinary. The committee after GST, of course, was rural sector taxation. And, again, I mean, he wanted to get the tax rates down and avoid all the rorts which were going on. And I've never forgotten he called in towards the end of the session. He called in Colin Moyle, who was Minister of Agriculture, and a bunch of other colleagues. And at one point, one of those people present, I can't recall who it was, said, Roger, look, take it easy, take it easy. Rome wasn't built in a day, you know. Take it slowly. And they just rounded on him and said, look, we don't yet know if this is right, but when it is right, you bastards are going to get out there and sell it. And I thought, boy, that's refreshing stuff.
Yeah, I've actually got that written down. Rome wasn't built in a day. Douglas pushed back that government's got once in a generation opportunity to fix things.
Yeah.
That was a great line. You can just imagine Douglas saying
that. Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Then, because going back, looking at the stuff, reading it, I don't think there's really a significant appreciation of just how central your role or influence was in that. And that's something I didn't really understand. The selling of that GST to the commercial community. And it's like, okay, we're going to do this. We're not going to repeat the mistakes of the VAT in the United Kingdom. And we're going to slash the headline rate. it was an incredible achievement, and I think it was because you had the mana to do it as well. I think Douglas would have really struggled to find somebody else. And I don't think that was incredible luck, Don. Let's talk about the Reserve Bank. I want to finish off because the whole thing is just so remarkable. The idea, so just taking a step back, so we're in a world where there were two types of models. You had the German and the American model, where the Reserve Bank had some degree of independence, nominal or real, and you had the British system that many other countries, including New Zealand, used, where the central bank was under the control of the political authorities. Then you had 1983 something, Barrow and Gordon and others were writing about, hey, where you have a situation of discretion, there is an incentive by politicians to lie, and that was driven by the Phillips curve. So before we start down this track, just give us a quick snapshot of the Phillips curve and how we got, in your Milton Friedman, put a stake through the Phillips curve.
I'm not sure I'm the best person to do that, but
of the two of us in the room,
I mean, Bill Phillips was New Zealand's greatest ever economist, and as his name implies, he gave his name to the Phillips curve, and he basically argued that there is a trade-off between inflation and unemployment.
Did he argue that though? Because I go back and I look at what he originally wrote, and he essentially looked backwards and says, when you know there's these two things, labor prices and labor demand seem to move, you know, countercyclically or whatever. I didn't get the sense that he said explicitly that there was a trade-off. I think that was what other people looked at his analysis and crafted that on. I think.
Yeah, that may be a fair comment. That may be a fair comment. But certainly, as popularly understood, he was arguing that if you want low inflation, you're going to have high unemployment and vice versa. And of course, that's been disproved. If you can change expectations and various other things, you can get low inflation and low unemployment.
Well, because the expectations is key.
Yeah,
because
that's right.
What emerges and why your role was so important, so interesting, was, I think it was Friedman, might have been Lucas, who said, it's not inflation that creates the trade-off, it's unexpected inflation. So if I think inflation is going to be 7%, I budget 7%, but if prices go up by 10%, I think things are doing better than they are, and that tricks me to make investment and spending decisions.
That's right.
So if inflation's at 7% and I'm the government and I want to reduce unemployment, I need to convince people inflation will be 7, then produce 10%, and that gets me the payoff.
Correct.
And then where did the idea for the independent central bank, how did that come into New Zealand? Whose idea was it?
I don't know. I mean, it was already accepted as what we were aiming at when I was appointed. I mean, I was running the Trust Bank Group and the Commercial Bank, etc. And Roger Douglas had said on the 1st of April 1988, when inflation dipped below 10% for the first time in donkey's ages, when asked, "Are you satisfied now?" He said, "No, I want inflation like 0 to 2." And a few months later, I was appointed to deliver that target.
Without appropriate independence of that. Not without
Without statutory independence. But in practice, after the Labor government won in 1984, the minister, Roger Douglas, told the Reserve Bank, "You guys are responsible for getting inflation down. Get on with it."
Where did the idea come from? I've been looking because I'm curious. I find this thing I need to talk to Roger Douglas. I'll track him down. He's in Roger
Bryce Wilkinson.
Well, Bryce Wilkinson.
You can't talk Roger Kerr anymore, of course, he's dead.
No, sadly.
But Roger Kerr, Bryce Wilkinson, those guys were clearly involved in Treasury discussions at that point. And and Graham Scott, of course, head of the Treasury at the time. So what particular books they had read or people they had met, I don't know.
Mm.
But the idea which was incorporated in the 1989 Act was, whereas, as you say, in the past, all central banks had either been totally beholden to the political process or at least notionally fully independent of that process, the 89 Act said the inflation rate should be chosen by elected politicians. They're the ones who should be held accountable for that. But they must be obliged by law to state what their inflation target is, so that if that isn't, that they can't manipulate the inflation rate in order to achieve political benefit for the result. But then give to the bureaucrats, the technicians, the job of actually delivering that, and if they don't deliver it, fire them. That was the concept.
Well, because you actually gave, you remember Michael Riddell, obviously, I interviewed him for one of these, and he made the comment that at one point you were interviewed, and somebody says, "So hold on, you're telling me that if you don't get it to 0 or 2%, you will be fired." And Riddell replies, "Well, Brash said yes." So it probably wasn't technically true, but it sent the message.
Well, actually, it may not have been technically true, but in a substantive sense, it was true. I mean, it was understood that the responsibility for delivering the inflation target was, at that point, on the governor alone. There was no Monetary Policy Committee,
yes.
Not in a formal sense, no legal sense. And I think I recounted my book, talking to Peter Nielsen, who was the minister or the associate minister designated by Roger Douglas to actually shepherd this law through Parliament. I noticed the fact the contract was between the Minister of Finance and the governor, not the Minister of Finance and the Reserve Bank. I said, look, surely it should be the Reserve Bank. And he said, as I quote in the book, we can't fire the Reserve Bank. We can't even fire the board, but we sure as hell could fire you. So I was very conscious of the fact that in theory and possibly in practice, my job was on the line.
Now, inflationary expectations. So I said before that with inflation, if I think inflation is going to be 7% and it's 10%, I as a business owner can be tricked into thinking conditions are better than what they are. But the reverse is true.
That's right. When inflation is higher than you expect it to be, but the community's expect it to be, real wages are reduced by that process. Wages are negotiated on the assumption that inflation is continue at 7. The political process, the government or the Reserve Bank cranks it up to 10. All of a sudden, your profits go up because real wages have gone down. You hire more staff and everything's good.
Well, it's not just that. The example I like to use is I'm running a shoe store and I expect to sell my shoes for $5. Because inflation is now running rampant, I'm suddenly finding I can sell my shoes for $6.
Right.
So I think, oh, okay, all right. Then there's obviously more demand for my shoes. So as a result, I go and build an additional factory.
Yeah.
But in one sense, though, you know, and because the Austrian economic theory is that we end up with too many shoe factories and then whatever, won't go down that rabbit hole. But in one sense, though, that is real. If I am tricked into building a second factory, that is real economic activity that wasn't there before. So it can actually, in the short term...
No, that's right.
And if that factory becomes added to the capital stock of the country, then, you know, maybe the...
And you hire more people to staff that factory. All of a sudden, people who thought they had wages increasing to reflect a 5% inflation rate realize the inflation rate is now 6 or 7. So they start demanding higher wages, and your profit margins have now got squeezed again.
That's true, but in the interim, there's now more people who actually need shoes because they're out there building the future. But anyway, in the short term, and even in the medium term, maybe, but certainly in the long term, it's vertical. But I want to come to this point. The flip side of that is also true. If I expect inflation to be 10% and it's 7%, then wages are effectively higher for my business. I see, or I can be tricked into believing that demand is falling. That has a real negative effect on the economy. So your role in 1989 to 1991 was to go out there and convince people that you had the capacity to drive that, to reduce expectations. And you had to do that despite the fact you had Hugh Fletcher ranting and raving and Muldoon.
Job Jones calling for my execution. Hanging a lamented key.
That must have been an intense experience. Because in 1991, well, in early 1992, the results came out and said in 1991 inflation was 1%. So that had been, so what was it when you took over? 9?
No, it was coming down. It kicked up because the GST rate was increased from 10 to 12.5, but it was on the way down. It was not as high as 9 when I started.
Right. But nonetheless, nobody expected it to be 1% in 1991.
That's true.
But just talk about that, because that must have been, you're the first person in the world to be given that explicit authority. Milton Friedman, you mentioned in your book, and because I'd forgotten that I'd reread it recently, Russ Roberts interviewed Milton Friedman in 2006. And Russ Roberts, who runs a podcast called Econ Talk, he put it to Friedman that Friedman was responsible for the expectations, monetary policy. And he said, no, he gave you credit in that 2006 interview. Don't tell me that was luck. But so obviously he knew you and he knew what you'd done. I'm just interested in the maelstrom of what, because you were out there, you were giving speeches, you were giving presentations, you were running the campaign of your life.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I would talk to anyone who would listen.
Well, you still do. You're talking to me.
Rotary clubs, farmers groups, church groups, anyone. And what I had to tell them was basically what my instructions had been. Get inflation below 2, or between 0 and 2, because the target had a floor as well as a ceiling, or else. And I quote in my autobiography, I got enormous help from Ken Douglas, ironically.
CTU.
At CTU. Because he understood that when inflation came down, we would be able to ease up monetary policy.
Mm.
Inflation expectations, I think, are of enormous importance. I quote an anecdote there. You probably missed it because I put it in the footnote. I had years earlier, been on a judging panel on a Television New Zealand quiz about how to get rid of inflation. You see the anecdote?
No.
And viewers were asked to write in with their suggestions about how to get rid of inflation. And I can't recall what the guy who won the contest suggested, but the guy who got second, I thought should have got first. He said, look, inflation is about expectations. If you expect prices to go up, you rush out and buy now quickly before prices go higher.
Yeah.
So you have to convince people prices are going to fall. They stop buying. Retailers have to cut their prices, and lo and behold, and he said, what you need, therefore, is what he called price slump sleuth teams, or PST for short, and he was going to, he put people to spread rumors. So he nominated his mother-in-law as the first leader of one of these teams. It was very sexist kind of suggestion. It couldn't be broadcast these days. But there's an element of truth in it. You've got to convince people. And you may have seen, it because I did quote it in the text, the conversation I had with Cullen for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And Cullen got it and won.
Yes. He
very, very quickly, I pointed out, how inflation expectations are important to getting inflation down. And he said, I guess you get a bigger increase in unemployment when you're reducing inflation than you get reduction in unemployment when your inflation goes up, because it's so much harder to reduce inflation expectations than it is to increase them, given our history.
Yes.
And he had it absolutely correct.
So he was better than Norman Cook, because you tell a story at this. I think both you and Goldsmith tell the story of Kirk and television. So maybe tell it again.
That's right. Yes, this was my attending my very first political meeting way back when I was just, I guess, late teens or 20. I can't remember exactly when. And Norman Kirk was the MP for the Littleton electorate, which encompassed Kashmir, which is where I lived in Christchurch. And I went to the meeting and I said, "Why does New Zealand build TV sets here at great cost?" And he said, because when we import them from Japan, they cost more after they paid New Zealand tariffs. And I thought, does he not understand it? Or is he hoping I won't understand? But it was, very sobering response from Kirk.
Well, because you also make a similar comment about Bill Birch. You said that you were concerned. Because you mentioned the finance ministers that you had, Richardson and Peters amongst others, and Bill Birch, and you say that you thought from the days on the planning committee that he had limited understanding of economic realities, but in reality you were impressed by him.
That's true. When I was in the planning council, Bill Birch was there as Minister of National Development, and he had the view that if we had any kind of resource, we should process it and manufacture it, etc. I don't know whether he talked about making shoes out of leather, but he certainly talked about using beach sands and various other things, irrespective of the cost.
Mercantilist approach.
Sorry?
The mercantilist
approach. Absolutely, absolutely. And I was sort of dismayed that he had still of that view, and I thought that was nuts. But having said that, he was a very good Minister of Finance in my experience. Worked like hell, and intelligent.
There are so many areas that we're coming up to the top of the hour, so I won't go all over them. I do want to, though, religion. Religion's obviously paid a huge influence in your life. Where does it sit now?
I would regard myself as someone who does not believe in a supernatural God. I don't think it's tenable to believe in such a being at this point in time, but you're right. Brought up in a Presbyterian manse by a quite remarkable father, but one who also moved with the times. I recall towards the end of his life, we discussed a book called Christianity Must Change or Die, written by an American Episcopalian bishop called John Spong. And I thought my father would be dismayed by this. I had read it, and he basically said, you cannot expect 20th century people to believe some of the stuff that the Christian church asks them to believe. Jesus walking on water, rising from the dead in a literal sense, etc. And I thought Dad might be disturbed by that. He said, no, he had no problem with that at all. He didn't believe those kind of supernatural things either. So he moved with the times. He was a very remarkable man.
So were you religious when you left home?
Yes, I was. I went to church every Sunday till I was into my 50s.
Yeah. Well, because that's you. So remember, you write about going to church in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. That's absolutely right. A truly remarkable church that my wife and I attended. So, yes, I was religious. Though even then, I was skeptical of some of the supernatural stuff.
At some point, it obviously atrophied. But there's a quote, again, I think it's from Goldsmith. You gave a speech in 1998 to a religious group. And it's interesting because you also write this in your book, in Goldsmith's book. You wrote to your parents a lot.
Yeah.
You make me feel guilty. I mean, we have email now, and you say to a congregation, it is sometimes said by critics in the church and elsewhere that the trouble with economists and politicians is all they seem to care about is money, balance of payments, deficits, where the really important issue concerns people. Few comments make me angrier. Why on earth do policymakers care about deficits and tax returns and the rest? Because, and only because, those issues have huge, huge actual and potential implications on people. And I thought that was really interesting. And you then go on to say you're grumpy because those who have struggled over the last 14 years to improve the deplorable performance of the New Zealand economy get virtually no support from the institutional church.
Right.
See, and I actually think it goes further. I think that there has been a failure in New Zealand to understand the legacy that we have inherited from Roger Douglas and Ruth Richardson and yourself and Michael Bassett and Cagle. And, you know, I think we are depleting the capital that we have inherited from the work that you and so many others have done. So,
well, you flatter me.
No, I don't think I do. And that's why, you know, I challenge you on the thing, incredible luck. I think, there is luck, obviously, because you've got to be in the arena to win. But you put yourself in the arena. There are so many other things I'd like to discuss, Don. Banking regulation. We didn't get onto Hobson's choice. We'll have to come back and do this again. Peter Ellis, and there's a link between Peter Ellis and Tikanga, which is wicked. So I'll have to get you back on this. All there's so much contemporary stuff that I'd like to talk to you about. But yeah, I hope you found this rewarding. Traversing the early years of your career.
Absolutely, yeah, thank you.
And we're here in the Taxpayers Union, who are very kindly letting us use the gear.
Mm. Thank you very much.
Maybe in the last hour we formed a government.
Yes, indeed. Here's hoping.
Well, it depends what it's like. Your old bank Winston might be in it.
Yeah,
all right. That's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.